multi online environment thing with the mag. I don't think I'll be going back there anytime soon. Have fun with your new computer.
Yeah, thanks. Talk to you later.
Bye, man.
Bye.
Eric Alex. Eric Alex. You can hear Eric Alex on We Talk Games, We Talk Games podcast. In fact, you might already be listening to it now. Oh, man, I'm very excited about our next guest. I don't know whether I should take this crowbar to the soda machine or threaten the bartender. Let's get Noah Falstein on the line. All right. San Francisco, go! Noah Falstein, hit us!
Hey.
What's going on, man?
Life as usual.
Yeah, yeah, good going on the West Coast. I'm on the East Coast. I'm the one with the headache. That's right, now I remember. Noah, you started in the video game industry in the 80s, 1980.
That's right, come up on 30 years in a few more months.
Fantastic. You worked with some of the greatest companies that I mean, when I go down my list of things I still enjoy to play and things that I think I enjoy to play until I play them, you definitely have worked for these companies.
Well, I've been real lucky. I've got a chance to work for some really great companies and often, you know, in startup mode, so I get to see them built out of nothing, and it's been a very exciting time.
Now, the first game that you worked on, well, one of the first games, I would assume, and probably the one that has resonated throughout the years with all sorts of gamers, especially arcade gamers and shooter gamers, has been Sinistar, and I'd like to just take a moment to talk about Sinistar a bit.
Absolutely. I actually worked for Milton Bradley, the company that, you know, makes better known for board games and puzzles, for a few years, but worked on about 10 projects, and every one of them was canceled before they put it out the door. So Sinistar was the first thing that I actually got to work on that shipped, and as you say, it still has quite a cult following.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I don't know, did you ever hear the philosophical relevance of Sinistar?
Oh, absolutely.
That's great.
Somebody had pointed out that to me online about 5 years ago, and I met the fellow who wrote that.
Any stories about programming that? What did you have to work with?
Sure. Well, I mean, it was an interesting project. That was in 82 that I started working on it. And
okay.
We actually ended up with a team of about 3.5 programmers and, you know, 1.5 artists and a sound guy. And it was a really big team for those days.
Mm-hmm.
Small by today's standards, but it was exciting to be coordinating a group like that. And Williams Electronics was a great company. We had a string of successes like Defender and Stargate and Joust and Robotron. And Sinistar was meant to, you know, come along and be the next big fast-action shooter at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought me in. I was one of their new guys, you know, assigned to this project that had been running into a little bit of trouble. They'd been having trouble getting it off the ground. And it came together really well. We had a lot of fun. It was a very tough game, both to make and to play. You know, we really tried to make it as challenging as the other games. And
sure.
As the project leader, I ended up tuning the game. So I kept making it harder until I was having trouble playing it. So that's how I knew we were at the right stage.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's actually, by definition, a tough game for me to play.
Very good, very good. And Sinistar, one of the my favorite elements of it, and most people's, especially the people behind the philosophical relevance of Sinistar, is the audible taunts. How early in the game design was audio a part of the consideration there?
Well, it came in pretty early. The original concept for the game came from a guy named John Newcomer, who had called it Juggernaut and had a somewhat different kind of look and feel. And when I came in, you know, John handed the reins over and we brainstormed a little bit. And Ken Fidesna, who was the head of engineering there, who was with the company until just a couple of years ago, had basically spent his whole career there.
Wow.
He was the one who said, why not put speech in? That we'd had a pinball game called Black Knight that taunted you in a similar way, and we had the chip for that and had never put it in a video game before and thought it was time to, you know, add some voice to the games.
Oh.
There had been a few that had been out before us that had done voice, but I think Sinistar was the most extensive use of it at the time. You know, even with only, you know, 7 different things that he said, that was quite a bit for a game in those days when, you know, memory was measured in bytes, not even, you know, K when you're looking at storage.
It wasn't speech synthesis, it was actually samples.
Yeah, it was samples, and it was we had a synthesizer for our sound effects. so that we could actually keep the data to an absolute minimum there. But the speech was all digitized, and at that point, the arcade games were really the high-end systems of the game industry, that the home game systems, this was before Nintendo even had their first console.
Sure.
So the standard was the Atari VCS that had 128 bytes of RAM and, mm-hmm. and 4K cartridges that, you really couldn't fit anything in there. So we had luxuries like, I forget how much was dedicated to the speech, probably something like 8K memory, which, as I say, was double the entire game for one of the Atari console cartridges at that time, but still an absolutely tiny amount by any standards today. The shortest song that people have is many times that size just to get reasonable quality. So, we crammed it in there. We got a radio announcer, in fact, from the Chicago area, a guy named John Doremus, to do the voices.
Oh, okay.
And he did everything except the roar. That we asked him to do a roar, and I wish we'd kept the audio track, because his best attempt was something like, it was just terrible. So we ended up blending together, I think it was a lion's roar with some special effects, or it might have been some other kind of animal that we got out of the local Chicago zoo. Somebody went down and recorded it.
Wow, fantastic. The whole game, as you said, you tried to make it difficult. And when I think about the next shooter to eclipse Defender or Stargate, I, of course, think of going out and mining. What more can you do possibly that's more aggressive than mining? But then Sinistar makes his appearance, and it feels like it's The Exorcist going on. There's some real tension there.
It was a game that made an impression on people because his entrance was delayed, and I have to credit John Newcomer with that, for coming up with the ideas. He was a really brilliant stager of things, and realized that if you didn't know what this thing was until partway into the game, and then suddenly it comes in and it's nearly invincible, your bullets don't touch it anymore, it would just really startle people. But the addition of voice and the fact that it just roars when it comes onto the screen, mm-hmm. a lot of people had the experience that the first time they played, when the Sinistar showed up, they actually were so startled they jumped back from the console.
Yeah.
Of course, he munches on their ship and they lose a life instantly. And happily, their first reaction was, I got to get this guy, who just killed me off, and not what a stupid game. But it really did startle quite a few people.
Yeah, it's a real gaming moment.
It was a really fun game to work on, partly because of the team. One of the things that I will remember for personal reasons is I hired a guy named R.J. Michael to do some of the explosions and special effects in the game.
Oh.
And R.J. returned the favor a few years later by introducing me to the woman that I ended up getting married to.
Wow.
I've been very grateful to him, and we've stayed friends all these years since then.
Another great video game union disclosed here on We Talk Games. We had Nolan Bushnell. He talked about many people falling in love over Pong, and now this.
Yep. Well, and in fact, RJ went on to start on the Amiga computer and met his wife at Amiga. So it was a multiple game and computer relationship nexus point that way.
I think maybe these online dating services have got it all wrong. They just need to bring people together playing games. Speaking of which, this will sort of jump around a little bit. I think a large body of your work, unless I'm completely mistaken, is focused primarily on the individual gaming experience, the personal gaming experience. Did you work on anything that was more of a social gaming experience, or anything in the plans for that, or...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I've worked on so many different things. I love variety so much that at this point, the simplest way to describe it is that I haven't done sports games, and I've done pretty much everything else, almost every type of platform and certainly every game genre.
Okay.
And in fact, when I was at Lucasfilm, I was sharing the office with a guy named Chip Morningstar, who was the lead designer behind something called Habitat that was the very first graphic-based virtual world. In fact, Chip coined the term avatar as it's used today. That he was the first one to use that for graphic representation of yourself that you see in an online virtual world.
Sure.
It was released as something called Club Carib on the system that actually predated America Online. But we had this up and running, I should say, Chip and Randy and Eric, the guys who worked on it, had it up and running back in 88, Commodore 64s with 300 baud modems, and yet they could actually have multiple avatars moving around in a virtual world and chat and teleportation booths and all the kinds of stuff that we've grown used to with online games now that really were pioneered way back then.
Sure, fantastic. Let's jump into Lucas. I know that you've done how many games you think that you worked on? 70, 80?
Oh, at least that many. I mean, probably about 70 or 80 that have been published or at least gotten out into the public, and at two or three times that number that, you know, were only in design phases or got canceled for one reason or another.
Right. Let's talk about a little bit about LucasArts. You worked there back when it was called LucasFilms and then into LucasArts, and you worked on a lot of the games that Spielberg was also involved with, and pretty much the inception, the birth of the SCUMM system. A lot of people familiar with gaming have heard of SCUMM, and we may even use SCUMM in probably an unlicensed manner of some sort. But SCUMM was a big push, a revolutionary graphical adventure game system. It was sort of a cross between code and a language.
It was basically a sort of an assembly language designed specifically for adventure games that Ron Gilbert and Eric Wilmunder, who I mentioned with Habitat, basically put together. And I had hired Ron to do the Commodore 64 port of Coronis Rift, the first game that I did at LucasArts back when it was just Lucasfilm Games. And Ron and I have stayed friends ever since then and worked on each other's games many times over the years. But he basically put that together to form the core engine that we used for most of the adventure games at LucasArts up through into the 90s. Then they eventually gave up and came up with a new system shortly before they killed off their current work then on adventure games. And happily, they've been reviving some of that and republishing our old games on Steam and embedding them in some of their new releases.
Now, I've seen some brief clips of the Lucas Ranch, the soundstage and studios. What was the game development environment like at LucasFilms?
Well, we were there for 4 years at Skywalker Ranch. I worked for LucasFilm for 8 years back from 84 to 92. And the middle of 4 years that I was there, we were at Skywalker Ranch, and we were actually the first creative group to work up there when it had just opened. We moved into a building that, in fact, was just finishing construction, and it was certainly the nicest place I've ever worked in my life and really ever expect to work. It was so beautiful and such a great setting. It's out in the hills here in Marin, close to where I live now. I came out here to work here and just fall in love with the area. George Lucas has great taste in places to live in the world.
Sure.
And it's a huge area. We had these beautiful buildings that were built according to a storyboard to look like they'd been around for 100 years. They actually artificially aged the wood and rusted some of the metal so that it would look like it fit in. And it's very much like walking into a movie set and getting to work there.
Wow.
Very comfortable. In fact, one of the exciting things was when we had the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989, we were actually having a meeting in the main house there in this gorgeous conference room with a giant mahogany desk. And the ground started shaking, and we were joking with Brian Moriarty, who had been the project leader on Loom, because he was very into earthquakes and had been putting up a map on his wall and putting in pins. So we said, "Hey, Brian, here's another one for your map." And then suddenly it got really serious and went from just being a mild shake to heavy-duty one. And Brian looked at us and said, "Everybody under the table." So it was sort of like a cartoon where I remember everyone looking at each other, seeing this solid, thick mahogany table, and the next thing I remember is almost all of us were underneath it, looking out. I don't even remember getting underneath, but it was a very beautiful place to work, and I've got lots of fond memories. One of our guys got one of the bullwhips. It was made by the same people who did it for the Indiana Jones movies, and would go out behind our building and practice by snapping the heads off of weeds, and he got really good at it, so it sounded like gunshots as he was practicing with the bullwhip back there.
Sure, speed of sound. Hey, did you ever see Joseph Campbell walking around back then?
No, we worked in that same library where those Bill Moyer shots were made, but they really taught you early on, if there are any celebrities around, and that there often were, to just act as if they weren't there and, you know, walk past them and ignore them.
Gotcha.
So there were a lot of recording stars in particular, because they did a lot of audio recording there. You know, people like Huey Lewis and Bonnie Raitt were there frequently, for example. But I never saw Bill Moyers, just a handful of other stars.
I see. And you mentioned how they tried to make this more like a mythical thing. What was George's involvement? Did his spirit of mythos trickle into any of your projects or all of your projects?
Well, it's interesting. George, you know, he has had amazing vision for the use of computers and high tech. He did some of the very early video editing. He started up the guys that spun off to become Pixar, and we were all part of the same computer division together. He started games long before, you know, other companies were even thinking about it. And yet he really isn't into that stuff himself. He doesn't like to play video games, and he would spend, I would say, no more than an hour or two every year with the games group, and we were a little bit disappointed right up until I got to work on The Dig, which came in from Steven Spielberg, who, you know, had come by to do some editing on, boy, I've forgotten the name of it now, it was Richard Dreyfuss as a firefighter. Spielberg was a real game nut and still loves to play video games all the time. And suddenly George was really excited because now his friend Steven wanted to play with the games group. And so he was suddenly involved with our early meetings on The Dig. And,
I see.
It was fun to work with both of them on that because they both put in on brainstorming sessions.
Now, completely off the record, except that I will broadcast it, did George ever share with you his ultimate plan to destroy pinball?
No, never heard that.
I guess he kept that secret then. Now, speaking of The Dig, which types of narratives do you prefer in adventures games? You like to do the, well, I guess you like them all, but would you say that you preferred the more comedy nature like the Sam and Max Hit the Road or more serious nature like The Dig?
Well, you know, I was one of the few people who spanned that. You know, most people specialized in one or the other. That Ron, for example, Ron Gilbert worked mostly on the comedy stuff, and I know he's got his new Death Spank that's coming out shortly. It's in the same vein. And in fact, Ron and I and David Fox were co-project leaders on Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and the only time we really had a serious disagreement was whether to treat the end of the game seriously or comically. And I was pushing for serious. Ron wanted comedy. And what happened is we compromised. We set up a random number generator, and some of the time it plays it my way, some of the time it played it Ron's way, and we checked over the code to make sure the other guy wasn't cheating on us and setting it up to just be random up until it was released and then switch over to the other side.
Right.
So I really like both. I mean, I think for adventure games, Ron has made a point that comedy is a really good thing to do in adventure games, so some of the puzzles are so obscure and ridiculous that if it's not a comedy game, it's just hard to take it seriously. And at least with comedy, you can laugh at using a monkey as a monkey wrench. But if you try and put that into a serious game, and many people have, then it just feels incongruous.
Yeah, right. It's not playing it for the truth. Can you divulge any Easter eggs that you personally might have put into games?
Oh, let's see. Well, you know, the very first Easter egg I did was back in Sinistar, where we stuck our names in the game, which in those days was a big no-no, and we were actually really afraid we might get fired if they found out we had done it.
And that was the first type of Easter egg, right?
Oh, no, I'm sure other people did it before we did. In fact, I remember hearing about that kind of thing from someone else before we put it in our game.
Okay.
But it was certainly the first one I know of that got into one of the Williams games. Lucasfilm, you know, we didn't put in that much. In Coronis Rift, I did something similar, that there was one of the levels in the games that essentially, if you put it into a level editor, which, of course, we didn't provide for the game, you could see my initials were the landscape, and I just started with my initials and built it in that way. But nothing too outrageous. You know, with the comedy games, we were pretty upfront about the funny stuff and the crazy stuff. We put in references to all of our other games, and I came up with something in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade where Indy's in a castle, and one of the comedy lines as he's trying to talk his way past the guards is, I'm selling these fine leather jackets. And for some reason, that one kind of got picked up and was in almost every adventure game we had after that. It was just a running joke, usually in the least appropriate way.
You talked about a lot of canceled projects. What are some of your favorite unreleased or canceled projects while working, and throughout your career even?
Well, you know, a lot of them were at Lucasfilm. We were very fertile in, you know, our coming up with ideas, but sure. You know, we only had limited resources, of course, to actually make them. One of my favorites was one that I worked on with Ron. It was his idea originally. It was something called I Was a Teenage Lobot. And it was really, I think, very cleverly set up to take advantage of what the computers of that time could do well. It was set in the future where they'd just given up on artificial intelligence and realized it was easier to take a person and lobotomize them and use their brain to control a robot. But only criminals were, you know, supposed to you know, be used that way. It was a death sentence, basically.
Wow.
And what happens is you're essentially Shanghai'd, that, you know, your brain, you know, you go to sleep one day and wake up as a shoeshine robot with your brain inside this robot body, but they haven't actually, they're keeping your body alive to use it for spare parts. So the object of the game, you're on a space station, so you're in this isolated area that was good for the computers we had at the time, and your object is to figure out how to get back into your body when all that you can do is say, yes, no, would you like a shoeshine, and that will be 7 credits, please. And from there, you kind of work your way up the ladder and get your brain put into different robot bodies before eventually you solve the mystery of who it was that disembodied you like that.
Wow.
Yeah, I still think that would make a great game. I've talked to Ron on and off that I think that would be a fun one to resuscitate.
Yeah, much better than Wirehead for the Sega CD. I don't know if it...
No, I never saw that one.
That's completely not this. Of all the Scum-based games to be released by LucasArts, which do you think are your favorites among the ones that you didn't work on?
Well, let's see. Probably the original Secret of Monkey Island, I would say. I worked on that a little bit. I contributed the idea of insult sword fighting to that, but... you know, really, I wasn't part of the core team, so I got to enjoy it more as a spectator than a developer. And I also really enjoyed Day of the Tentacle, that was done primarily by Dave Grossman and Tim Schafer. I just thought the comedy and the puzzles in that one came together particularly well. I particularly like the time travel puzzles in that game that involved some pretty outrageous stunts.
Well, one of my favorite $700 systems has got to be the 3DO, so I have to know what your involvement with the 3DO was there.
Well, I was employee number 9 at the... It was actually called SMSG when I joined. They hadn't even named it the 3DO company.
Wow.
And I worked directly for Trip Hawkins, who had, you know, started the company after starting Electronic Arts. And it was quite a wild ride. I was just there for the first 2 years, really, as we went public. And it was my friend RJ that I mentioned from Sinistar. He actually worked on the hardware for the 3DO and let me know about it early on after I left LucasArts and said, you really should come here and get involved in this startup. And it was really ahead of its time. I mean, what Tripp envisioned was kind of like what, you know, the Xbox 360 is today, that he hoped that we could build that with the technology of the mid-90s, and of course it just wasn't quite possible. But that idea of having a disc-based system that would play movies and play high-resolution games, and one of the things Tripp used as a selling point is that he envisioned this future where it would all be, you know, hooked up, networked together, and you'd be able to play a game and watch a movie and see somebody wearing clothes on the movie and say, yeah, I'd like to buy that, and, you know, be taken to a Macy's account to order it online. And this was all, you know, pre-worldwide Wide Web. So he was really quite a visionary on that. But as you say, $700, which wasn't our original intention, it was a pretty stiff price to pay for a game console. Corrected for inflation, it was still the second most expensive console, I think, of all time. With I think it was the Neo Geo was the only one that actually cost more.
Yeah, I had Neo Geo. I had another very expensive system to import was the Super Graphics, the NEC Super Graphics, which was a successor to the PC Engine Turbo Graphics. But I also had the 3DO, and I had the CDI as well. Those were all pretty expensive systems. And the Laser Active, that was expensive as well.
But I worked on almost all those systems, not on Laser Active, but on most of the others at one time or another.
Really? Fantastic. Well, the 3DO, I mean, hey, you couldn't go wrong because you had Shelley Duvall's It's a Bird Life that you could play in there for 6 months.
Yeah, we had a little trouble with the launch titles. For a while, that was going to be our number one launch title, and we were pretty horrified, but they came through with... oh, God, what was it called? It wasn't Road Rash, but it was...
Crash and Burn, that's what it was called.
Hey, very good. Absolutely.
Yeah. Boy, yeah, I still can play that. You know, it's a little rough because the pixels are showing their age, but it still has a lot of comedy to it. It's still a big production for its time.
Yeah. Well, that was really... Strauss Zelnick had come over from the movie industry to head up Crystal Dynamics and really wanted it to be treated in the same level as movie productions. That in the mid-90s at that point, there was a big push to blend Hollywood and games. And in the games industry, we were a little resentful because the Hollywood people were kind of coming in and trying to take over, and that didn't work out too well.
Right. You had mentioned about bringing back graphical adventures, making a resurgence. Of course, you know, every genre of games goes through swells. And I don't think anything really killed graphical adventures, unless you might think something did. I don't think there was necessarily a proliferation of graphical adventures. I just think it went through its natural cycle. But Telltale Games has brought back familiar franchises like Sam & Max and most recently Monkey Island. What do you think of the Telltale's episodic gaming formula?
I think it works quite well. I mean, it lowers the barrier to entry. We wanted to do that, you know, back 20 years ago, but the market wasn't ready for it, that you really need online distribution to make episodic work, because if you're selling a game in a store, a cheap episodic game takes up just as much shelf space as a much bigger, you know, full-price game, and yet it only makes a very small margin for the store owner. So there always was tremendous resistance to putting cheap games on the shelves. But, of course, when you don't have shelves, then there's no problem. Mm-hmm. And it means that people can try something episodic and you know, see if they like it before they commit to the whole thing. I think it's great. I played the first episode of the new Monkey Island game, and Dave Grossman, who was involved with the very first couple of Monkey Island games, has been creative director over at Telltale and doing a great job, and they have a lot of other ex-LucasArts guys there, so they've kept a really nice feel to it.
Oh, great. What systems do you currently own or play?
Oh, a little bit of everything. I have to say, just on Saturday, a couple days ago, I got my first iPhone, and I've just started to put games on that, and I'm already in love with it. I have a feeling I'll be playing a lot of games on that one. I've got an Xbox 360 and a Wii. I've played a lot of Wii games with my daughter and my wife, and I had a PSP, but the disk drive died. I have a DS that I use all the time when I go to the gym. I play whatever the latest version of Advance Wars is as I work on a stationary bike.
Oh, great.
And it's a way of using my game addiction in a positive sense, because I burn a lot more calories when I'm playing that game than I do when I'm just trying to pedal.
Oh, there you have it. You hear it here first. And, boy, talk about a system that really would work well on graphical adventures. I think the iPhone could do that quite well. I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I've been talking to my friends about that, and I really think we're going to be seeing a lot of not necessarily. See, I'm a little bit leery of graphic adventures. That, as you say, they never quite died out, but they certainly, particularly in the U.S., went into a very quiet phase. Mm-hmm. And I think there were, unfortunately, some pretty good reasons for that. But the most important one, it's a bit abstract, but in every other type of game, you can gradually, incrementally get better at advancing through the game, you know, whether it's, you know, killing monsters or accumulating objects and going up levels. But with adventure games, it's solving puzzles, and you either solve the puzzle or you don't. That, you know, hint systems can kind of get you partway there, but not really, and it's not very satisfying to partially solve a puzzle. Mm-hmm. And it really is a fatal flaw, I think, at making adventure games, at least in their kind of classic point-and-click solve the puzzle method, mass market. And that's why Ron's new game, for example, is more in the Diablo role-playing vein. You know, we're a lot of us are trying to experiment now with bringing the same kind of story and even in some cases humor to new game genres, but not be stuck with puzzle solving is the only way to actually progress through the story.
Gotcha. Great. Well, that's very exciting. What are your thoughts on the shift from raster graphics to the polygons in the graphical adventures?
Well, I've always been kind of agnostic when it comes to graphics. That the first game that I saw at LucasArts when I came to interview was Rescue on Fractalus, that was way ahead of its time, doing essentially a first-person 3D game with, you know, they did a lot of trickery to make it look right, but at the time it was much more realistic as a 3D flying and shooting game than anything that had been done before. So all of my career, really, I've been on that edge of 2D and 3D and new technology. Really, I think gameplay is much more about what you do as a player, and the graphics are really the aesthetics and the veneer, and it's certainly important, but, you know, in the same way that a sports car will look a lot better with a beautiful paint job, but you still don't start thinking about the paint before you start building it. It's you know, the last thing you put on that way.
I see. For the past 13 years, you have formed your own company, The Inspiracy.
That's right. I've been basically working as a freelance game designer, and at this point, with 13 years under my belt, I'm pretty sure I've been doing that longer than anyone else in the world. I probably would have heard about it if there was anyone else who's continuously being a freelance game designer. And it's been great. I really love the lifestyle, and I love the variety that it brings me.
With The Inspiracy, I went to the website, of course, and I looked there. There's something else very interesting to me. Serious Games and, of course, the 400 Project. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, that was something Hal Barwood, who was my collaborator, co-designer on Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, he and I became friends back then in 1992 and have basically stayed friends ever since. And about 7 or 8 years ago, he gave a talk at the Game Developers Conference in San Jose at that point about the idea that there might be 400 or so rules of good game design. And he set it out almost as a random number, just he had come up with four rules that he wanted to talk about, and so four of the 400 sounded great because of the alliteration. It wasn't really a serious study, but it really intrigued me and a lot of other people, and I went to Hal and said, how about if we start collecting what these rules are from other game designers, write up our own? And so we've been doing that, primarily me, actually. I did it through the Game Developer Magazine design column that I wrote for about 6 years. And we've got a few hundred of these at this point, and I've recently actually started expanding it. I'm thinking of doing a book about it. They range from really common sense stuff, practical things about the process of design, like how you should probably start with a middle level in the game and not the very first or very last level, to more abstract things. There's a quote from Albert Einstein that I particularly like, where he said, everything should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler, which I think is a wonderful premise for a lot of game design.
Yeah.
I've talked to a lot of my game design friends about it, and we've kicked it back and forth, and it's really, I think, a very useful tool in the arsenal of most game designers at this point.
Yeah, definitely. Anything else that you wanted to talk about?
I mentioned Serious Games just because that's been a fascination with me. That's really a very new area that involves games that have a purpose beyond entertainment. That often it's training and education, but it can also be persuasion. There was a game, for example, called Darfur is Dying that was put out as a student project to show people what was going on in the Darfur region in Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
There are games that actually treat illnesses, everything from arachnophobia to attention deficit disorder to
wow.
Parkinson's. There are games to help train doctors and healthcare givers. Games, I worked on a recent one with my old friend Larry Holland, who did the X-Wing and TIE Fighter games. We did a game for Cisco Systems to teach network engineers about basic networking. And
wow.
My sense is that in another 10 or 20 years, games and interactive learning simulations are going to be a bigger business than the entire entertainment game industry is right now.
Wow, that is very, very interesting, and that's definitely what our listeners and the whole We Talk Game crew is all about, is that integration, that vision of understanding that it goes beyond gaming. It can, it doesn't have to. It can go into learning, it can go into the arts, it can all be a happening of life.
Well, and I should say one of my favorite projects I worked on as a serious game was something called Remission from a company called Hope Lab. And that was actually done to help teenagers with cancer learn why they have to stick to their chemotherapy treatment
wow.
regimens. And the thing that was really gratifying about it is that they did a huge study, I think $3.75 million just to study its effectiveness, and found, quite to everyone's relief, that it actually made a big difference in getting these kids who normally would tend to stop taking chemotherapy drugs because the drugs themselves made them feel sick.
Sure.
And teenagers are not really good at abstract thinking about what's going to happen to them.
Sure.
But by playing the game and really no other factor, because they did a double-blind study with this, it actually helped keep these kids on their chemotherapy regimen. And it was basically a third-person shooter game, too. It's very violent, but you're killing bacteria and cancer cells. So when people talk about how violent games should be banned, I like to bring that up as a counterexample, that it's actually saving the lives of kids with cancer. And like many other censorship arguments, if you start to get too far over and say everything should be banned and it's just all terrible, you end up throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's all part of life. So, I mean, life is nothing but eating other things so that you can live. That's really a dynamic story. And Noah, you are a trove of video game information and experience. I'd love to have you on the show again. Maybe in the future we could talk about some other things. But thank you so very much for taking time out of your schedule. Noah Falstein, thank you for being on We Talk Games.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Wow. In my opinion, another great moment for We Talk Games. I think that Serious Games is incredible. I cannot wait to learn more about this. Let's go cross the pond, man! Let's bring the other co-host in here. And it's Garthy, go!
And we're gone.
Johnny Capcom, what's going on, man?